Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 125 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Mark.
Now, Hayden isn't with us today. Since his marriage last year, for some unaccountable reason, he keeps having other things to do. You know what they say, marry in haste, have no leisure. But stepping into the breach is the more than capable form of our guest this week from the Flight Through Entirety podcast. It's Brendan. Brendan?
Brendan?
Where is he? Did you already guess, Mark?
No, I'm...
Brendan? Brenny?
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 Where's our Brenny?
Brenny! Oh, hang on, is that someone tapping on the door? Who is that? Is that you, Brendan?
Yes. Yes, it's me, and I've gratefully accepted this invitation onto the Diddly Dum podcast, so that leaves me with only one question. Could somebody please shoot me?
Mark! Put that down, please. You're going to hurt someone. You know you can't shoot through a 6-inch thick reinforced steel security blast door.
No.
Oh, look. Hayden's left the cat flap open again. Computer, will you open the doors, please? Brendan! None of those bullets hit you, did they?
No, it's alright. I got thrown. Totally off screen, but it looked really, really expensive.
Come in, old chap, come in.
Wow. This place is like... It's full of crystals, and they're actually yellow. They don't look pink and have to have been tinted yellow. They're actually yellow. Except when they're blue, but I like the yellow. Wow. It's like a rock salt lamp.
I have to say that Rob Irwin's reaction of surprise was more convincing. So, Brendan, tell us about the Flight Through Entirety podcast.
Well, we have been making our way through Doctor Who, in order, since 2014. Next week we start recording...
2014? Really?
2014 was our first episode.
Wow.
Yeah, 2014 was our first episode, which was episode zero, which has frustrated the building of websites ever since. So next Saturday, which will be at time of recording, which will be the 1st of February, we start recording our Partners in Crime Series 4 set of podcasts. Yeah, so I think we're up to about episode 170-something.
Yes, you started May 2014, so you're only a couple of months younger than us. Gosh, I didn't realise that.
Yeah, it's been a very long time.
I know what you mean about numbering. We started with 001, and I'm just hoping that we all decide to give up before we reach 999, because I don't know how I'm going to start renumbering everything.
You've got your very own version of the Millennium Bug.
Yeah.
You'll have to start numbering things 001.Delta17.
Yes. We could get millions in grants from the government for that, Mark. So, who are you on the podcast? I didn't realise until you told me recently that you're actually all roughly in the same area, aren't you, of Australia?
Yeah, we all live... most of us live around the inner west of Sydney, our regulars. The outlier of that is Todd, who lives about a 20-minute, half-hour drive north of us. But I live almost on the same street as Nathan. James lives almost on the same street as Richard. And so we sort of take it in turns to host. I don't think I've hosted a recording since I sort of gave up chief hosting duties, because when we finished the classic series, I kind of went, okay, I'd like to, like, just do half of them now. It is very time-consuming. And I've just realised they've made about 60 episodes now with me just popping in and out, and
Nathan and James in charge.
Was that a coup?
No. I just came to the realisation that as much as I enjoy the new series, as a fan of the classic series, I've sort of got my impressions of it as a child and as an adult, because I came to it just as it was winding up. Whereas the new series, I only really have my impressions of it as an adult. I have enough to talk about, but I don't know if I have enough to talk about every single episode, because even though my opinions, say, of the Rust of the Navy's era have changed in 15 years, by the way, it's been 15 years that we've had Russell T. Davies' vision of Doctor Who, I wasn't sure they'd changed sufficiently enough to warrant me being on 13 episodes.
No, I know what you mean. Also, there's that thing that when you're talking about old episodes that you watched when you were younger, there's more context, and you can talk about what you were like as a fan back then as well. You can colour in around it, whereas I think with the new series, we haven't got that, have we? We've just taken it.
Particularly when we're reviewing a live series, and there's barely enough days to either for the fury or the joy to settle down. Was it you or Hayden last time was talking about the benefits or the problems of nostalgia?
Oh, I think that was Hayden, I think.
Well, Brendan, I'm warming to you already far more than I ever have to Hayden or Mark, so keep it up. And there could be some serious changes before next time. Before we get on to talking about the last two latest Doctor Who episodes, have we been up to anything interesting recently? Mark, for you and me, that's in the last 2 weeks. Brendan, that's for you, that's for your whole lifetime. What have you been up to, Mark? Have you been getting any more Doctor Who-related stuff, or is it just dried up over Christmas?
No, there's nothing really to add. No, nothing since my Gallifrey T-shirt.
I was meant to get my Season 26 Blu-ray box set on Monday. Then I was woken up at about 6 o'clock in the morning on Monday by a text from my bank saying, there have been several unusual payments from your account, so we blocked it. The unusual payments were I'd spent about £10 at the supermarket on a Sunday or something. So we'll now list for you the most recent transactions. And if you recognise these, just reply yes and we'll reopen your account. So they listed these few, and the final one was something like 6 a.m. Monday morning, payment to zoom.co.uk declined.
Oh, no.
Because they'd blocked my card. So, bloody hell. So I had to redo that. Well, that apparently is just on the way now, so Sylvester's era. If they had just declined it completely, might have been an advantage.
I love Sylvester's era.
Well, are you quite a fan of Sylv, Brendan?
Well, Sylv was the Doctor when I got into the show, you see, so...
Yeah.
He's my Doctor, and... Sylv's and Tom's episodes were the ones that the ABC constantly repeated here. And I know that's a point of great jealousy for UK fans that Australia got constant repeats.
Yes.
And you guys didn't. Like, seriously, I seem to recall basically when Sylv premiered, I think in 1988, I'd already been watching off-air tapes from my dad. And so we recorded Sylvester, and it was like they'd have a new run of Sylvester episodes, and then they would repeat a couple of seasons of Tom Baker until they got the next run of Sylvester episodes, and then they'd repeat more Tom Baker. And it was just in constant rotation for about 8 or 9 years here, I think, in the 80s and 90s.
Given that sort of constant looping, do you find then that it's therefore less common in Australia for fans to think of the concept of having My Doctor, or... Is it just as common as in the UK? You know how I tend to think mine's Tom, because that's when I was at a certain age during his era.
I think the concept of My Doctor in Australia works until the end of the 80s, when they start repeating all different eras.
Yeah.
And then in 1993, they did a repeat run from Spearhead to Revelation, but at 4:30 in the morning. Yeah, I think after that, when there started being all these repeat runs, that notion sort of went away and then came back again with the new series. That's the impression I get anyway, because no one my age was into Doctor Who. It was just me. Despite all these repeats, no one at my school watched it. You know, of course, later on I met James, who's only a couple of years older than me, for instance. Yeah, I always found that very weird. You know, it's on 5:30 in the afternoon when I'm a kid, or 6:30, it did move around. When it was on at 5:30, it was sandwiched between other kids' shows. When it was on at 6:30, it was The Goodies at 6 o'clock, Doctor Who at 6:35, and then the news my mum liked to watch. So, you know, we got a whole hour and a half on the ABC at that point. Yeah, it always struck me as odd that I was the only kid at school into it, because it's like, it's right there.
Is that because it was generally thought of as quite nerdy, or did you just go to an extremely sophisticated school?
No, it was thought as quite nerdy. Yeah, it was seen as quite nerdy.
So were you going around your school playground going exterminate, exterminate with your arms in front of you, and everyone else was just politely ignoring you?
Yeah. Nobody knew what the hell I was doing. I remember very specifically conning two of my friends into basically playing Genesis of the Daleks. And having to explain the runaround in part one, that is the exact scene I was embodying, and one of them had to be Sarah and one of them had to be Harry. And they'd never seen it.
Yeah, it's funny. To be honest, I don't think when I was in the later years of school, I don't think I knew anyone else who was as into Doctor Who as I was even then. And that pretty much carried on through the 90s into the early 2000s. It wasn't really until it came back that I started finding other people that were into it at all. And that's still only really on the internet that I found those people. There's nobody in my sort of circle, my social circle.
Of course, for some of us, those years are so long ago that like we can't really remember. I must have done, because I remember every Friday at junior school, we used to all go off to the local swimming baths. And I do remember being in the deep end with my best friend when he said to me, I said, "Did you get anything nice for Christmas?" And he said, "Oh yeah, I got a scale model of." This is quite pathetic. I got a scale model of Nerva Beacon, and I, for several hours, loathed him with the heat of 1,000 suns, which was a fandom which thought that the Weetabix cards were the coolest and most elaborate thing they'd ever seen in their lives. That's not surprising, really, is it? Whereas now you'd think, what, a little piece of cardboard? I'm not going to stop eating cornflakes for that. It all turned out to have been a fib on his part, of course. No such model ever existed.
As a child, I ached for that sort of thing, because even now, getting Doctor Who merch over here, I think in the heyday of the new series with David Tennant, it still took about a year, 18 months, for the action figures to arrive in full force. We were screening the episodes 3 months after the UK for the first three series.
Oh, yes, you were. Well, I remember that now. It did seem unusually long.
And the thing is, Series 4, so this shows you the power of showing things in a timely manner, Series 4 screened only a week after the UK because they wanted to put it on Saturday night.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it won its time slot most nights. And got Big Brother cancelled.
Oh, wow.
It was rating better than the Big Brother eviction show. And all they had to do was show it in a timely manner. It's like, ABC, you could have been, you know, you could have been getting even better ratings for the last 3 years.
I suppose with merchandise, you were lucky enough that you were in a big city.
Yes.
As I was in Manchester. Imagine you'd have been out in, were you out in Kent by that stage, Mark? Or in Wiltshire?
What, the start of the new series?
No, when you were a kid watching Doctor Who.
Oh, in Wiltshire. But just down the road from Longleat, though.
So if you're either there or out in the, I don't know, in the outback somewhere in Australia, you'd have even less chance of getting... I mean, I didn't know that all these fanzines existed when I was a kid, because obviously we didn't have the internet. The only thing I vaguely knew was sometimes I'm looking on the adverts in the back pages of the Target novelizations, and occasionally when Doctor Who Weekly came out, I'd become more aware of it. But there we are. So, 2 weeks ago, roughly, Orphan 55 screened. directed by Lee Haven Jones, written by Ed Heim, who I think wrote, what's it called? It Takes You Away, that Swedish one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Last year. What did we think? Brendan, tell us what you thought of it. Give us some early thoughts.
Okay, let's start positive. I liked the first 15 minutes. I liked the last 5 minutes. The rest is such a mess. I think there is a decent production and story in there screaming to get out. And I think where it really falls down is in the direction of the guest cast. I'm getting feelings of Hayden Christensen in the Star Wars prequels, not necessarily being a bad actor, but not being given adequate direction of who his character is. And I feel that from most of the guest cast.
Yes.
Yes, I was just thinking also, I wondered if you were referring to Silas suddenly having a massive tantrum and walking out into a Dregs-infested holiday camp.
Yeah, that is the nadir, because, you know, we could say that Vilma just being utterly unaware of the danger around her is the nadir, but at least that's given us memes, you know. Silas, who, his whole character is he is very intelligent and underestimated, yeah, goes off on that tantrum, which makes no sense.
No, there's been no build-up to it at all, has there? There's been no sign of them getting particularly annoyed with each other. They seem to have been getting on fairly well, and then Silas just suddenly goes, I've had enough, I'm going, and just runs out of the safe room into danger. There was lots of strange plot points like that, really. I do wonder how much was, I think you said it plot singed all over the place. It felt to me like there was, I agree, I felt there was loads of bits cut out. Felt like it had been heavily, heavily edited.
Mm. I was just about to say that. I wonder how, I'm not saying that somewhere, they started out with a perfect episode and they tried to, but I wonder how much, because there's a line when they're all in the truck where I think Bella or someone else says that her mum made Nevi, who I think is Silas's father, her mum made Nevi look like Parent of the Year.
Have you got anyone else? Is your mum around?
She died when I was about Silas's age. She made Nevi look like Parent of the Year.
Now, nowhere else in that episode is there a suggestion that he's a bad father.
No.
Or an incompetent father. And you think, well, could they seriously have just come up with that, not realising how jarring it would sound? Or is there just a lot of stuff that they had to cut out?
Yeah, or is the way Ed Heim wrote it that when Nevi says to Silas, like, oh, no, don't do that, because the way James Buckley plays that is kind of knockabout lad kind of way, but was it written like he was really, really harsh, but nobody told the actor?
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's the kind of thing I'm wondering. Everyone gives this sort of very neutral performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I say they're kind of bad performances, it's not like they're sort of lackluster. It's just like they're totally middle of the road, except, in my opinion, Bella and Hyphen with a Three. And I really like Hyphen with a Three.
Oh, you don't.
What? See, that was pretty much my reaction when I saw her on screen, actually.
The squirrel.
Yeah, I couldn't work out. I thought, well, that's ridiculous. She really did look like she'd literally stepped straight out of 80s Doctor Who, one of the lower budget episodes, and straight in onto the set of Orphan 55. I mean, I do guess that that's not accidental. You know, that's obviously a deliberate choice. It's not like they ran out of budget for the makeup, so they thought, oh, we'll just kind of draw an animal face on it. That's clearly designed choice, but it's never really explained in the plot, which makes it just look risible. There's not a line suggesting that it's some kind of furry cosplay kind of thing. I felt a bit sorry for the actress because I saw a lot of people, I saw her tweeting that she was very proud to be in Doctor Who tonight, and then I saw just loads of people going online and just ridiculing her squirrel outfit.
I know. And I felt a bit like when they had Sleep No More, they had an actor called Bethany Black who had been tweeting beforehand that they were the first openly trans I'm forgetting some of the details of this, actor cast in Doctor Who. And I thought, oh, that might be interesting. And then they cast her as a sort of a neutered, genderless, almost like a member of a cattle race.
Mm.
I remember thinking, oh, that's more than a little insensitive. And I bet lots of people will be thinking, oh, that's an exciting innovation. I'll watch that. And being perhaps ones who know her thinking, oh, you're brilliant. But she wasn't given much to do.
No.
Yeah, that was Bethany Black in Sleep No More.
Yes, yeah.
The funny thing is, a bit like Hyphen with the Three, her character is my favourite in that episode, and I'm not too fond of that episode generally. I actually rate it lower than Orphan 55. But the reason she is my favourite is she is playing this, as you say, neutered cattle race, but everyone says, oh, they don't have emotions, you know, they're just this.
Yeah.
But she gets that arc where she has a crush on one of the other soldiers and tries to save him and sort of at one point just picks him up, throws him over her shoulders and runs into the fire.
And also, like Hyphen with a Three, she's not taking sides in the argument, is she?
No, because...
You know, she's not on the side of Bella, she's not on the side of her mother, she's not on the side of the doctor or anything, she's just this poor... Because I remember going on social media after my first watch of this, and I couldn't believe that so much of the resentment was being directed. The squirrel character.
Yeah,
and I thought, I don't remember her being that... I remember her being, you know, not particularly noticeable. I remember her being that offensive. And when I watched it again, I thought, no, she wasn't at all.
No, her appearance is strange, but I think also she's got one of the best lines in it, hasn't she? When the doctor tries to inveigle her way into the linen room.
Yes.
Hang on. All this out of a friend of mine.
Well, we do not make any judgments on our guests and fully support any way you choose to enjoy yourself here at Tranquility Spa.
I cackled so hard at that line. And to me, that's the moment that makes it clear that she is a human wearing a costume. It's kind of like, we don't judge your recreational activities. Look at me.
Especially when you consider that there are so many other open goalmouth targets.
Yeah.
Just begging to be... After this episode ended, we put up a poll on Twitter asking if you had a gun but only one bullet, who would you shoot? And the results we got in were 44% went for Vilma, the annoying wife.
Uh-huh.
44% went for Bella, the annoying daughter, so a tie there. And only 12% for Silas, the annoying son, which quite surprised me. So you'd have thought that unless they were slightly confused with the whole mother-daughter relationship, they didn't know whether it was acceptable for them to say, oh, what's an awful characters, or whether they felt they should be supporting one or the other. What was your initial reaction, Mark? Did you start by liking it the way Brendan did? Well, actually, that's unfair of me. You might well have liked that it all the way through. Fire away.
Yeah, I struggled with it first time around, to be honest. I think I found it quite hard to follow. The bits that were quite bad kept throwing me off. I think there was some dialogue that I didn't like. Some of the conversations between Ryan and Bella I found a little bit cringeworthy.
Mm.
Also, I mean, we were talking about the plot as well. There's things like, why are they all in the truck? Why have they all got in the truck to drive out into the cursed earth, basically?
Oh, well done. 2000 AD reference.
Yes. That truck's very much like the Land Raider, isn't it, actually? It's very similar shape to the one from Judge Dredd, the Cursed Earth. I was hoping they were going to find a rock-eating alien called Tweak.
Tweak?
Yes, Tweak. Or a jolly green giant fighting Ronald McDonald.
Oh, God. This man is on fire tonight. Is any of this meaning anything to you, Brendan?
I know a little 2000 AD.
Yeah, Cursed Earth's one of their most famous classic epic storylines. I think it was the first sort of epic Judge Dredd storyline, wasn't it?
Famously, they come across, they're going across this radioactive wasteland, and they come across two societies, one based on the worship of Ronald McDonald,
yeah,
and the other based on the worship of the Burger King, and they're in constant wars against each other.
Yeah.
And 2000 AD had to withdraw, because the Burger King and McDonald threatened to sue them.
Oh, yeah, no.
It took years. Oh, and they also came across
the Jolly Green Giant.
Jolly Green Giant and other sort of registered trademark characters as well that had all come to life at some point. Yeah, I mean, why did they all get in the truck at the same time? I don't understand it. Because they had the ionic membrane up, didn't they, at that point? So it should have been safe back in the city. So why everyone... As well, you could have taken some spare oxygen things then, couldn't you? And it just all seems a bit silly, really. And then, I know what will transform Cerulean 3 into Cerulean 4. Which is what we need to get the teleport working. It's a Hopper virus. I just happened to have one in a bag in my pocket.
That was dreadful, wasn't it?
It's, really? But I think, actually, to be honest, I think I did like this one more on the second watch. Because I'd kind of primed myself to enjoy the bad bits.
Yeah.
So, for instance, rather than just goggling at the actress who... Oh, who's the actress who plays Wilma?
Julia Foster.
Julia Foster, thank you. Instead of just goggling at Julia Foster's delivery...
So it wasn't Jenny Laird from Planet of the Spiders.
Very similar delivery styles. Her delivery of that, we're getting him back.
That doesn't sound like my Benny.
The drag's gone. We abort.
If those things have got Benny, we're getting him back. You want money, Kane? That's worth a fortune.
Made me laugh with pleasure the second time round, instead of just wincing with pain, which I did the first time round.
It rather put me in mind of Brian Croucher as Travis shouting, "If I'm guilty of murder, then so are all of you."
After a year of Stephen Greif playing him with a perfect received pronunciation accent, he suddenly becomes a Cockney.
Yes.
That explains it, actually. You've been considering today how you're going to review performances by Vilma and Silas and Bella. I don't know, why do you have that shotgun with you?
But there's other bits I found funny, which was supposed to be funny, I think. This is a routine tranquility drill. Relax. I thought it was great. And when Nevi says...
sure, it's nothing to worry about.
I just thought that is a classic Doctor Who.
Oh, it's a sort of what could possibly go wrong line.
Yes, exactly. It's like when those two guys walk into the underground caves in the Silurians. And there's this huge roar from a dinosaur. One of them goes, "Oh, it's probably nothing." But as well as that, it's very, very dark in places, wasn't it, this episode? Very dark. I mean, the dregs, when they were filmed, like especially when it was just focused on their faces, and you did it before you had any idea of what their bodies were like, were properly terrifying. They reminded me a bit of, does anyone remember an old, I think it's 80s sci-fi horror called Extro?
Called what?
Extro.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
How do you spell it?
X-T-R-O, I think. Yeah, it's trash, I think, but it's...
Extro is a 1982 British science fiction horror film directed by Harry Bromley Davenport. Well, that's all.
Oh, well, there we are.
Oh, yes, they do, aren't they? Just looking at them.
So, yeah, another 80s reference they managed to get in. But one thing, I thought the dregs lost a bit when you saw them full on.
Yeah, where they were standing up on that sort of plane, roaring up at the sky. Yes. Yeah.
You know, before I sort of imagined them as these kind of sleek, extremely quick killing machines. Rather like, you know, a xenomorph. But instead, suddenly looked too bulky and they looked too slow. And there was never any footage of them really moving, was there? They're only ever standing there, really, or walking slowly. And I think there's that bit... where there's a bit when they're in the tunnels and they get down to the tunnels and Kane says, "Oh no, they'll be too fast for us." And I thought, well, that doesn't look very likely, does it? Bless them. Yeah, I don't know what anyone else thought about the dregs.
I can imagine children being very scared of them.
Oh yeah, they were. Both my friends whose kids watched it said that the dregs were really scary.
I mean, what were they doing to Benny? Were they... eating him? Had they... What I could have understood... You know when Benny's shouting through the... that was almost like our intro, wasn't it? He's saying that silly thing through the wall of the truck.
Wilma! I can't believe you came! I'm not alone, and I don't have long. But I have two questions. I'm sorry you asked us together, but will you marry me?
Oh, of course I will. Yes! What was the other one?
If anyone can, will they please shoot me?
I've got two questions. A, will you marry me? And B, that's almost like he's playing it for laughs while he's being eaten. Now, if it had been something like, let's think of an example, something in Doctor Who. Like the Wirren with Noah, where the dregs sort of, by eating him, they absorb his personality or something.
Mm. Mm.
That might have been interesting, because then they could have been taunting them.
Yeah.
Inside. That's, in fact, perhaps we should just pretend that's what they were doing.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, but they were having fun, weren't they? That's what that's what Kane said about it.
Yeah, that's true.
The dregs were having fun with him. Mm. So I guess, to be honest, the episode was so dark in places and they're worried about their younger viewers, perhaps, so that they maybe cut a lot of that out and left it for the imagination of the grown-ups.
That's a bad idea.
What's that?
I'm leaving it to the imagination of the grown-ups. Because all we had to go by was the script.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, again, no one's told the actor playing Benny what's happening to him, so he doesn't know how to play it. A theory, because as well as Flight Through Entirety, we do a weekly flashcast called Jodie Into Terror with kind of our immediate reactions on the episode.
Yeah.
And on Jodie Into Terror, James raised the idea that to him, he thought Benny was turning into a dreg. And that's what happens.
Yeah.
And I just went, wow, you know, that never occurred to me. That's a really great idea, which could have been referred to, spoken about, even shown through makeup. And it's just not.
No.
No, that's interesting.
None of those things happen on screen. I think that's a wonderful option, but yeah.
Is Jodie Into Terror an entirely separate podcast?
Yes. So yeah, we have a separate feed for it.
Oh, right. That's why, according to my iTunes read, it looks like you've not been broadcasting since Christmas. Oh, right.
Yeah, we haven't been.
Sorry, I'll just go and search for it and subscribe to it.
Thank you.
Oh, what have I been missing?
You've been missing our hot takes.
Can I also recommend Brendan on as a YouTube channel where he's filmed himself walking to work the morning after watching Doctor Who as he... expresses his thoughts whilst trying to negotiate the traffic.
Everyone's really worried about me crossing roads. Like, I've had at least three comments, don't become Danny Pink.
Oh, God.
Well, I think we'll put this in our show notes, which can be found at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Listeners, if extensive show notes, anally analysing everything we refer to in this podcast. Now, how do we get onto that?
Are we talking about dregs?
Is he being eaten by the dregs, Brendan, you were saying?
Yeah, just, it's a moment that, on the first view, I thought, oh, this is really darkly comic. This is exactly the kind of dark humour I want in Doctor Who.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it was only, I think it was after I recorded my YouTube video, I was just sitting at work and went, hold on, what the hell was actually happening? Like, they didn't say. What a con!
My housemate said to me, about 5 minutes after that scene, he said, ironically, not intended, he said, where's Benny? What actually happened to him? I was like, didn't you... I said, the dregs had him. He said, but what happened to... I said, then the woman said she'd shot him. He said, yeah, but did we see that bit? I said, no, that happened off screen.
Yeah, that whole escape from the space bus thing was so badly put together.
Yeah.
You know, they're running away from the space pass, and it's like, oh, Kane, what are you doing here? They threw me. It's like, oh, that would have been fun to see. Where's Benny? I shot him. Oh, well, that would have been fun to see, and given the actor a death scene. But no, let's not show that.
Yeah, and also, like I said, they never showed the dregs doing any pursuing. They never showed anyone, like, running with the dregs gaining on them super fast or anything. You just saw the dregs standing there roaring. Ah! It's like, oh, no. One bit I thought that worked, another dark bit from that, was Hyphen's demise.
Hyphen, hurry!
Her blood-curdling scream was quite incredible. One of the most horrible screams I've heard on Doctor Who for some time, I think. And I just thought, wow, that was very dark to put something in quite as blood-curdling as that.
Especially when you consider she was the one character in the whole episode you didn't really want to die.
No, because she's like a teddy bear, so it's like...
Well, are you two sitting down?
Yes.
Yes.
Because it's my job now to bring a little optimism to the review.
Oh.
Well, I wasn't expecting that.
I think it started out very promisingly. Maybe comparatively promisingly. Almost from the get-go. Where Yaz says, oh, this might get you out of your Mardy mood. And the Doctor snaps back, my mood's fine. And I thought, oh, that was good. And possibly the first time the Doctor's ever been called a mardass by a companion. Even the slight grimace that Doctor gives at Graham Speedo's joke.
Yes.
Looks not just natural, but actually perfect comic timing. Wasn't particularly amusing, but it was really good comic timing. And then about 3 minutes in, we had the vending machine virus scene, which really made me sit up and take notice. First of all, we get Ryan walking into the foyer of whatever it is of this spa. And he's not so much walking as doing a little dance across the room. Sort of almost the opposite of Adric walking.
You leave Adric alone.
So it seems a great change from what we usually get with Ryan, which seems to be cutting it to him for a line and then immediately cutting away. Then in walks the Doctor. And what given some of the woodenness we've seen so far, you might expect her to walk in, stop, turn left, and walk up to Ryan. But what she actually does is she turns towards him by just adjusting her stride in midair. And it does seem trivial and not worth notice, but for anyone who has been suffering through some of the physical acting in this era of Doctor Who, it's almost a joy. As is the whole business with the Hopper virus, where she's doing this physical acting business with Ryan, doing the Eric Morgan thing with the crisp packet, grimacing as she hauls into his feet. And all the while, probably for the first, maybe the first time ever, or a rare time, dashing off exposition effortlessly. Then Ryan does his usual party piece, which is jumping around in the background, flapping at things, which he does quite well a few times. And it's capped off with the Doctor reassuring the other people standing around, he's fine. Followed by another little nervous tick, which is a cane. Great comic timing from Jodie, and I'm thinking, what's changed here? Is this a new director? Is Jodie becoming more confident in the role? Or is it that with all that complicated physical business at the vending machine and the crisp packet, they had to take the time to thoroughly rehearse it beforehand? I don't know. Whatever it is, I watched and rewatched that scene about 6 or 7 times, loving every second of it. And I thought, is this the start of this era of Doctor Who climbing upwards? Well, not really, because it's downhill from then on. I don't see how it can be that no one has cottoned on to the fact that there's not enough for three companions to do or say. The very last thing you need is to add a host of half a dozen other characters to draw even more screen time away from them. Are Vilma and Benny really needed? Are Nevi and Silas really needed? Because it's a case of spreading too little Vegemite over too much toast. That wasn't too patronising. See what I did there? You start with a show where you struggle to care for the people there already because there's no time to give them little character moments. I'm talking about Yaz and Ryan primarily. And then you double or treble the number of people and make it even more difficult. Nevi and Silas definitely aren't needed. And if they are, why would Nevi be useless as an engineer?
With Nevi and Silas, it's very much like Hong Kong Fu, isn't it? As in, Hong Kong Fu is actually useless at everything, and it was his cat Spot that did everything.
Oh, yeah!
I think Nevi and Silas are very similar.
Don't get me started on, oh, it's as green as the hair on our heads, son.
It's like, so yeah, that's your real hair, that's not a wig?
I'd be prepared to bet that was an inserted Chibnall line. I mean, it's as green as the nylon joke shop wigs on our heads. It would at least have been accurate. And it's starting to make me wonder. Just before, at the start of the Skyfall two-parter, they had the companions back in Sheffield living their normal lives. It made me think, if there isn't enough material to satisfy all of them, why not leave the odd companion back on Earth? You know, Yaz has to go off and actually do some policing for a while.
Yeah, see, I think
the point with Nevi, and again, we don't get it in the direction, because I sort of think to myself, if Nevi's such a useless engineer, why is he employed? And the answer I come to is that Kane is cutting costs. Like, this is a low-cost operation. She's got herself, she's got Vorm, she's got Nevi, and she's got Hyphen. But as I say, it doesn't come across. And sort of what you're referring to, you know, making one character look good by making another character an idiot. I wrote an essay for a book called Hating to Love, and in that I wrote for The Beast Below. And I predicated my whole essay on the fact that the plot only works because the Doctor acts like an idiot. And the Doctor acts like an idiot so Amy can have her moment of saying, oh, look, I'm clever too. And it's something that...
Yes, yeah.
It is hard to balance when you have a character like the Doctor to show their companions as intelligent and autonomous people as well, because the Doctor comes in and takes charge. But in this situation, you know, Silas is kind of so mardy that it doesn't feel like a triumph when he gets stuff right.
No, it just feels like an annoyingly precocious child.
Yeah, it's a Wesley Crusher problem. And, you know, that's not a slight on Will Wheaton. And I am sure that there were 10-year-olds watching this going, oh, God, that's just like when my dad tries to operate the DVD player. Oh, that's just like when Mum can't get the modem working. I'm sure there were kids out there identifying with that character. But as Sidney Newman once said, children characters have a hard time relating to anyone older than that child themselves.
Yes.
And I think we get that here. If the character is 15, viewers over the age of 15 will have a hard time relating to them.
Yeah. Well, I related to Adric when I was 9 or 10, I think.
Absolutely. I have never met anyone who was a child or a teenager in 1980 to 82 as a Doctor Who fan who hates Adric. It's always people who were adults when that rocked around who hate Adric, I find.
Yeah.
And especially my brother was that age. My whole family watched Doctor Who, but I was the only one who became a diehard fan. But even now, when we talk about Doctor Who, something my brother said was very interesting. He's 10 years older than me. The death of Adric affected him so much, not because he identified with Adric, right? I would have been a baby, and he figured this out years later. When Adric died, he saw himself as the Doctor and me as Adric.
Oh.
And I was like 1 or 2 years old, and it really disturbed him. Yeah.
Oh.
What a decent older brother.
I think he would have been 11. Yet children are so hard to get right in Doctor Who. We've had worse children in Doctor Who. Yeah, I know a lot of people point to Chloe Weber. For my money, the worst presented children in Doctor Who are actually Angie and Artie Maitland in Nightmare in Silver.
Oh, Lord,
I just find them utterly insufferable. Whereas I don't mind Fear Her that much, and I actually find the young actress playing Chloe Weber does Scary really well. Look, Silas is a believably mardy child. I just think he would have been more entertaining if he was a bit less mardy and a bit more saffy from Ab Fab, just, you know, mildly disapproving. Oh, look, I think the big problem is direction. No one's really told James Buckley or the kid who plays Nevi exactly what their relationship is. Like, does this kid really resent his dad?
Yes, yeah.
Does this kid really love his dad and he's helping to make sure his dad keeps his job? You know, is it Penny and Brain from Inspector Gadget always helping out but never letting on because they don't want everyone to know that Gadget's incompetent?
That would have been interesting.
Yeah.
Slightly unbelievable. But I don't think you'd mind if it worked properly, if it was done effectively.
Yeah.
And it was amusing but slightly credible.
Yeah. Something that has annoyed me about the critical response to this episode, and that is people are saying, oh, it feels like an episode of the McCoy era. And sort of using that as a sort of thing of, oh, you know, well, you know, of course it's a bit rubbish. And I kind of look at that and I go, you know what? I'm a fan of the McCoy era. I am not blind to its faults. But the McCoy era was poorly scheduled, poorly funded, in a deliberate effort to kill off the show.
Yeah.
And its successes, therefore, are titanic because the entire team was working against
a hostile environment.
In what sense are you using the word Titanic here? Enormous or sinking fast?
Actually, both. Because, you know, the Macquarie era has the BBC working against it and still pulls out stuff like Remembrance of the Daleks and Ghostlight and The Curse of Fenric. You know, that era succeeds in the face of overwhelming opposition, and I feel like Orphan 55 has no such excuse to suck.
Yeah.
Orphan 55 has the full weight of the BBC behind it. It has an incredibly talented crew. Lee Haven-Jones did a wonderful job with part two of Skyfall. Ed Heim wrote It Takes You Away, which for me is one of the best episodes of last series. Apparently it has a very talented cast. Like, well, okay, James Buckley has the capacity to be incredibly funny. The woman playing Kane, I'm told, is a big actor on some other show. And I'm not trying to be shady there or anything, it's just that I don't watch much other TV. Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, of course. There's an immensely talented but wasted cast here, and I'm sorry, I don't think it has the same excuse as the McCoy
that's
era.
Laura Fraser.
Laura Fraser, that's right.
It almost seems like stealing candy from sweets from children to bring up the Vilma and Benny thing, but what is it? Do you know, this might not mean anything to you, Brendan, but it will to Mark. Do you know what Julia Foster was in, Mark?
Somebody did mention this. I can't remember what it was now.
Do you remember the East Shore Michael Winner adverts where he's saying, "Calm down, dear"?
Oh, right, yes, yes.
Oh. Some insurance companies don't want to insure me. There's a company that only wants good drivers. They don't want you to pay for my repairs. The company's eSure. They could save you up to 30%.
You went into the back of my new car!
Calm down, dear. It's a commercial. I'm really a very good driver. That's why I'm with eSure.
Hello, Mum. I'm on the telly.
Call eSure on 0845 045 3000 or buy online.
And that scene at the end where she runs to her death.
Which one of you hurt my Benny?
Is this written for us to make us laugh as she's dying? who's just walked in? Brucey, what are you doing here?
Hello, good day, ladies and gentlemen. What a wonderful audience, so much better than last week.
How can we help you, Brucey?
I thought we'd like to play a quick round of Play Your Bennies Right. Okay, the rules are very simple. First of all, I'd like Doc to guess how many times the word Benny appeared in the episode Orphan 55. And then, Brendan, I'd like you to go higher or lower. So, Doc, how many times do you think Wilma said Benny in the Orphan 55 episode of Doctor Who?
I'd go for 18, Bruce.
Would you like to go higher or lower, Brendan?
I'd like to go lower, Brucey.
Well, you're quite right. Well done, Brendan. You've won this beautiful Goblin Teas Made tea service. Because answer is 17.
Oh, very close in the first place.
Yes, you were. Oh, thanks, Brucey. You're very welcome. Goodbye.
I've been in hotels who provide those Goblin Teas Made. Or am I thinking of chambermaids?
Uncanny, Mark.
I think, Bruce, you've got to get back between the time dams, which are sustaining your existence. And for me, he could have died the minute he went back in that corridor for his hat. And I thought, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
I don't like to sound callous, but he deserved to die. There's Indiana Jones doing it in the Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they, at the beginning, where the gate's coming down, and he puts his hand under last minute to fetch his hat. If it's successful, it's comic relief from danger. If you do it and you die as a result of it, it's just bloody stupidity. Some bits and pieces. If Kane is running this facility to try to finance the terraforming of the Earth, then when you've only got an average of about 23 guests at any one time, it's not a good idea to give 2 weeks free bed and board for four people in exchange for six coffees. Plus the cost of teleporting someone across the galaxy from inside the TARDIS. And maybe that's just an excuse to stop the Doctor solving problems by having the TARDIS with her. But if you don't want a tooth hat, don't do it in the first place. Hey, Graham's increasingly becoming a bit of a giddy cockney. There's a strange thing where the doctor says of the tannoy, all guests to the linen cupboard immediately. And someone says to Graham, it's probably just a drill. And he just accepts that. In fact, it's the doctor's voice saying it. So you must know the doctor's not just pissing around. Exposition doesn't always work, does it?
And why is your gun fitted with an Exipex modulator? They randomise laser output. You'd only need that against a thing that could adapt to your attack.
Oh, it's the Borg!
No, I didn't think much of it, really. It started off so promisingly. And I can't understand how all that... I thought it was joyfully good, that stuff around the vending machine when she was curing you of the Hopper virus. And suddenly it goes... I don't know.
I was just going to say, I think you've picked the exact moment where it goes off the rails, and that's when Benny goes back to pick up the hat.
Yes.
And it's a matter of, I just don't think he'd do it, and I think Vilma would have noticed earlier. You know, it's just a situation where I think if he'd noticed that, he would have said to her, oh, Vilma, your hat, you know.
Yeah, where's again, your hat?
Yeah, it's bad direction, and it's a character acting like an idiot just to further the plot. Especially seeing as, from the earlier scenes we've seen him, Vilma does seem to be a bit oblivious, you know, to what's going on around her. Yeah. Like, obviously he's trying to propose to you, whereas Benny seems sort of quite clued in, and he's like, oh, Yaz arrives, and I was like, oh, damn, this is entirely spoiled my proposal, I need to get rid of her, and he tries to do that. Yeah, that's the... I think you pick the exact moment where it goes off the rails and everyone starts acting like idiots. My Walk to Work with Whittaker videos, I even did an extra one saying, why does everyone get on the space bus? Here is what they should have done instead.
That almost reminds me of that Blake 7 episode where they get light years away from this Federation base they've just bombed before they realise that Kelly wasn't with them.
Oh, God, yes, yes. Years ago, actually, really years ago, I was still living in the UK, Big Finish had one of their writing opportunities, and it was for writing a Blake 7 novella.
Oh, right.
And, yeah, the story I put in, I sort of took that idea as my starting point, and pretty much Kelly and Gan get left behind after a raid, and Avon manages to successfully, logically argue not going back for them because Gan is useless, and Kelly has taken over the ship 3 times since she came aboard.
Auron may be different, Kelly, but on Earth it is considered ill-mannered to kill your friends while committing suicide.
And I called it expendable, and it was basically about Kelly and Gan having to save themselves. Because Avon convinces everyone else they are not worth the trouble. Well, he doesn't convince Blake, of course, because Blake would never agree to that. But the others are just like, actually, yeah, we've almost got killed several times because Gan can't hit something.
How did you do in the competition?
I didn't win, and they don't provide any other feedback beyond that. And meanwhile, Kelly and Gan get caught in an explosion and Gan's consciousness is transferred into Serverland, which I thought was a rather amusing idea. So you've got Serverland in Gan's body and Gan in Serverland's body.
Oh, and unable to kill anyone.
Yes, yeah, unable to kill anyone. And, you know, you've got Gan, like, slinking around his cell trying to seduce guards. And I thought it would make for a very interesting novella.
You didn't get one of those letters back that said, Dear Brendan, thank you for your story. It was both funny and original. Unfortunately, the funny bits weren't original and the original bits weren't funny.
Did anyone guess particularly earlier that the dregs were humans and that it was
it was Earth.
Planet Earth.
Not until I noticed that the writing on that sign was Russian.
Right, okay, because for me it was, I got my first inkling when they named the dregs, because the dregs of humanity is quite a, we were playing catchphrase.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the elite all fly off in spaceships and leave the others to die.
Oh, yes, that...
was a little heavy-handed, wasn't it? You thought, oh, that's... Is that something significant that's going to come of that?
That was a Brexit klaxon, wasn't it, as well?
So that's either all the people in suspended animation on Nerva Beacon Or it's all the people on the Ark with the monoids? Are the elites who've said, sorry, we're leaving you behind?
Yeah, so yes, that's what it's the ruling elite that evacuate the planet and leave everyone else to suffer, which, yeah, that was my Brexit klaxon for that episode. What about the ending?
What, the whole thing about, is it too heavy-handed?
Well, yeah, plus also, because BBC America put out a trailer saying, you have to watch this episode right until the end. And I saw loads of people filmed reaction videos thinking, because you think Spyfall 1, you had the revelation of the Master. Spyfall 2, you have the destruction of Gallifrey. And then they must have thought, wow, what's it going to be at the end of Orphan 55? This is going to be huge. So I'm going to film a reaction video to put on my YouTube channel. And I watched a couple of them. And it's great. There's these fans sitting there that they're all wide-eyed and go, here it comes. It's, we're coming to the end now. It's coming to the end. And, okay. I have to say, it didn't seem quite so bad the second time around. But I didn't really like the line, oh, they're so busy arguing over the washing up while the house burns down or something. And I thought that seemed a bit, it felt a bit cliched to me, but, because I seem to have heard that sort of phrase used a lot recently.
Right, I think we'd better move on, otherwise we'll have an enormous podcast. Hayden has so generously left us an audio cassette of his opinion of Orphan 55, so if you just pop this, it's a TDK C45 cassette, just pop it in.
Hello there, my lovely Doc and my lovely Mark. I'm very sorry I can't be with you on this occasion, but unfortunately, events have conspired against me, much like they would do in a Doctor Who episode themselves. But anyway, yeah, let's get on with my thoughts. Orphan 55. And tricky one to review this, because tonally I think it was a tale of two stories. It seemed like it was trying to be something along the lines of, you know, Paradise Towers, you know, light with a sort of with a darker edge to it. But I just just felt off. It didn't feel particularly strong to me. I felt like a lot of the criticism that I can label at this, and I think Doc will probably be jumping to joy here, was actually in the dialogue. And I think that the way that the whole script was realised, I just don't think it was a very strong story. I wanted to like it. There was part of me thinking, well, actually, half of this is a very, you know, a really good concept. You know, this Tranquility Spa, which has sort of gone wrong. You know, and you have got these dregs who are coming for you on the other half. And I just wondered whether this may have actually benefited from being a two-parter, giving the script a little bit more of a chance to breathe. I think we felt the benefit of that at the start of the year with Spyfall. I think if you have a two-parter, maybe it allows a little bit more of that sort of rich storytelling to come to the fore. I mean, this is Ed Heim, obviously, who wrote this one too, who did It Takes You Away, which was, I think, one of the more middling to stronger episodes of Series 11. I'm not saying I had high hopes for it with Heim at the helm, and also with it coming hot on the heels of Spyfall. It was just a bit disappointing, really. I've seen the arguments that a lot of the more environmental issues of the story were a little too on the nose. I think if that's the case, I think you've been watching the wrong show for the last 50-odd years, because it always has been the case with Doctor Who, especially since the Pertwee era. I think maybe it's in the realisation again, though, from Jodie, and of course the direction too, from Lee Haven-Jones, which it was the tight shot on her face with this very frantic, like, don't you see, if you change things now. It didn't need to be pitched that way, that line at the end. Although I thought the jump scare to the dregs afterwards was something which would probably, if you were a kid watching that final frame, that final shot, will probably live long with you. I thought the realisation of the dregs was good as well. But I don't know. I mean, James Buckley, if you're going to employ James Buckley in an episode of Doctor Who, and then put him in an episode which was for 45 minutes of its runtime, deadly serious, it doesn't quite work. And it doesn't work as well if you're employing an actor like James Buckley, who of course is famed over here for playing Janie in Between Us, as a comic relief in an episode that doesn't really have much. And you've kind of already got that with Bradley Walsh, who's, you know, more than capable of providing that comic relief in the story. I just don't think he was really needed. It's, and if it was not stunt casting per se, but trying to get someone on board, I mean, I don't want to sound mean here, but it's not like you're getting someone who's riding the crest of a wave with their popularity right now. So I just thought it was a little bit redundant. And the father and son and mother and daughter story was a bit ham-fisted. I don't know, not fantastic. It's not a brilliant story for me. Incredibly middling. I'd be very harsh to give it a 4. But I think I'll actually give it a 5 because it had its potential. But there were just a few things going against it. Especially, oh dear, Julia Foster as Vilma. Ben Fogle's mum. And Ben Fogle, to anyone who doesn't live in the UK and is listening to us, he's sort of, just imagine Prince William with better hair. You know, a bit of a foppish TV presenter. This is his mum here. And that amount of times that she's shrilling Benny's name is just, oh dear. Yeah, not brilliant. Very aggravating. And Doc, if you haven't put Julia Foster saying Benny over and over again to the tune of Benny and the Jets at some point in this podcast, I'll never forgive you.
So, marks out of 10, I'm going to give it... I would give it a 3, but I will give it a 4 just for the vending machine hopper virus scene. But that's me being extremely generous.
I'd go higher than that, because I quite enjoyed it second time round. Higher. Shush. I'll go...
Don't start the bees.
Yeah, I'll be here all night. I'll give it a 6.
Yeah, I'm also a 6, because despite my many criticisms of it, I still enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed the sort of zombie horror movie aspect of it. It's just the characters weren't great.
Okay.
Disaster didn't stymie, Louis Pasteur.
No, sir.
Edison took years to see the light.
Right.
Alexander Graham knew failure well. He took a lot of knocks to ring that bell.
So when it gets distressing, it's a blessing. Onward and upward you must press. Yes, yes, till up from the ashes. Up from the ashes. Grow the roses of success. Roll the roses from the ashes of disaster. Roll the roses of success.
Start the engines.
Success.
Batten the hatches.
Success.
Man the shrouds. Lift the anchor.
That song could easily be a tribute to the process of recording and editing a podcast. Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror. Directed by Nida Mansour, I hope I'm getting the pronunciation right, who will also be directing this Sunday Fugitive of the Jadoon. Written by Nina Metivier, I think, which on certainly on Hayden's other tape, he took about 4 run-ups to get that right. who actually, she's... In a way, she's a bit of a Terence Dix in that she's been a writer, a producer, and a script editor. She was the script editor for It Takes You Away last year and for Woman Who Fell to Earth.
Wow.
You know what I mean by I'm saying that she's quite Terence Dix? She's done it all. She's been running things behind the scenes, and she'll be jumping in every now and then to write an episode. So, in this episode, the man who holds the commercial rights makes a fortune, while the man who did all the work gets paid a pittance. Yes, welcome to the story of Terry Nation and Ray Kurzweil. Shall I start?
Yeah.
Yes.
For me, this is a great improvement on 55. I was quite depressed when I was watching it last Sunday, because I think I was so uptight about how bad Orphan 55 was that I was almost expecting this to be bad. And so I was subconsciously, I think, ignoring the good bits and focusing on, there's another rubbish bit. Look how right I was. And so I rewatched this last night, and coming home from work last night, I was thinking, oh, Lord, I've got to rewatch this. I can get away with not doing it. But I rewatched it, and I thought it was pretty good. There's a great improvement on Orphan 55, but there what wouldn't be? While we still had the problem of introducing two or three new characters on top of an already overloaded TARDIS, at least here, Tesla and Edison are well cast, well characterised, and their story is well explored. It wasn't like Ada Lovelace and Noor and Yat Khan, where the history lesson really just amounts to, you're Ada, you're brilliant, goodbye. You know, show not tell. Here's this character from history, and we'll use this story to show why they're famous. We won't just take the Doctor's word for it, that they're famous and brilliant. It's just epistophany, it's all the silliness with this Scythra had to be added. Which made me think, do we think... No, actually, I'll come on to that later. We just... sterling performances, I thought, from Robert Glenister, who was, of course, in a previous incarnation in Doctor Who.
Oh, Claims of Androzani.
Yep, Saladin.
Yes.
And Goran Vujinic. And unfortunately, this class of the performance from those two and the power of their rivalry did rather highlight the purposelessness of the three companions. Something I noticed is the Doctor seems to be constantly telling people off. She calls Nikola Tesla a big fat liar twice in a space of about 2 minutes. Just because she doesn't know him yet, which I thought was a bit... She's there in front of that Scythra queen on her ship, and she's telling her off. I mean, I think big fat liar is really isn't on a par with something like... what does he say to Sutek? Your name is abominated in every civilised world, Sutek, you big fat liar. I mean, in something like Brain of Morbius, does the Doctor ever actually tell... He doesn't really converse with Morbius, does he, apart from briefly at the end. But does he ever tell Solon off? He more sort of menaces Solon, doesn't he? I've got your number, sweetheart, and you're going to save Sarah or whatever. But even more annoying than that, of the rare lines that get fed to Ryan and Yaz, quite a lot of those consist of lecturing people. They even have Graham doing it here, which you might have thought might work better coming from an older man, feet-on-the-ground character. But even that's daft. He says, I imagine this is meant to be a great line for Graham, in the same way that the Doctor's end speech about the global warming was probably meant to be a great speech, capital G, capital S, for the 13th Doctor. He says to Edison,
"Bet you'd jump at a chance of having back working for you, wouldn't you?"
"Yeah?
Yeah,
how'd you figure that?"
"Because I had a supervisor like you at my old depot. And men like you don't pay a bloke that much attention unless you think there's a payout coming."
Well, you understand his point, and maybe if it had been where I come from, we've got a politician like you. But a supervisor of bus drivers at a bus depot. You can only imagine, can't you, the cruel financial manipulation of people's lives which happen in a bus depot.
Yeah.
It just seems... Ugh. Someone jump in on me before I start getting... because I quite liked it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, that line from Graham, it's a great line, and it's a great observation of Edison's character,
yeah.
And it's something we can understand in the modern world. But how does that relate to bus driving? You know? I thought to myself, hold on, you know, we already know, for instance, that Ryan works in a warehouse while he's trying to become a mechanic. We know that he doesn't really enjoy the warehouse job. Why not have him talk about his supervisor, who's really pressuring everyone to get stuff done because of the bottom dollar? You know, and he has singled out Ryan because he knows Ryan has bigger aspirations in life, or rather different aspirations, I should say.
Yeah.
And so he picks on Ryan, and that would have made more sense coming from Ryan. Something I think you said on Orphan 55, Doc, Graham's becoming... He is becoming a bit one-note.
Yeah.
You know, he sort of has the witty lines. Of course, he's Bradley Welsh, so he delivers them brilliantly. But I think we might be encountering a bit of a Rose problem with Graham. And what I mean by that is Rose's story arc was really completed in Series 1. And then they had to come up with another story arc for her in Series 2. Graham's story arc, of course, is mourning for Grace, which we know from Spyfall is still going on.
but it doesn't appear to be the big thing this series it was last series.
It was clear in Skyfall, as he actually now, he and Ryan get on perfect.
Exactly.
Quite well, don't they? Which is almost the resolution of the story arc.
Yeah, and that's that was exactly the other part of his story arc. So it's like, well, what now? We're hinting at a story arc for Yaz, where she's possibly becoming a bit disaffected with travelling with the Doctor, and I think this story does touch on that, because Yaz is kind of a little bit patronising to Tesla in the beginning, and then they get that scene together where they're talking about his work and how people react to it. And I really like Mandip in that scene, because it gives her a new side. Because we haven't seen Yaz kind of be... Sort of in the lead-up to that, Yaz has been sort of a bit dismissive of Tesla, like, oh yeah, not heard of him, etc., etc. And we haven't really seen that side of Yaz before. Yaz is usually... She's either really, really nice, or she doesn't like someone. And she hasn't had the opportunity to sort of do what some past companions have done, which is kind of, in a historical setting, be like, oh, you know, I'm on the holodeck. I can say things about people. And she suddenly sort of seems to realise, oh, actually, no, he's a real person in front of me. This isn't a history book. And it's done without kind of lecturing or polemics or Tesla turning around or Dorothy turning around and saying, actually, he's a great man. Yaz comes to that realisation by herself. Unlike yourself, I did come to this episode smarting after Orphan 55 and hoping, I really hope this one is better, but that meant I really latched on to the good bits in this episode.
Mm.
With the Doctor kind of telling people off, I kind of like how Jodie tells people off, because when Peter Capaldi tells people off, I sometimes find it quite unpleasant to have this very imposing figure be telling off characters, and it's kind of like, oh, this isn't, you know, when the Doctor tells people off, it should be a little bit funny.
Yeah, the caretaker was awful, wasn't it, for that? Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, that was that bizarre. Suddenly the Doctor, out of nowhere, hates soldiers.
Yeah.
Mm.
It was weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, not liking guns, there's a big leap to hating soldiers.
Especially one who's given up being a soldier and is now a teacher.
Yeah.
It might have been interesting if it had been going somewhere.
Yeah.
But you seem to have forgotten by the next episode.
Yeah, but when Jodie tells people off, like, the big fat lie a bit, I really like that, because it's just a very light scolding, and as the audience, you're like, oh, what is he lying about? What is he lying about? Oh, he's lying about not having seen anything strange. It's like, no, that's fair. It's a rising and falling action. You think there's some big revelation coming, but actually it's just, no, it's this thing you saw in the last scene. He didn't tell me. It's like the Doctor saying to you as the audience, can you believe he didn't tell me he'd seen something weird? What am I even doing? What am I even doing? Why do I bother? Why do I bother Nikola Tesla?
I'd rather it had been something like, is that really the truth? Knowingly. Rather than just big fat lies. I just don't... I can imagine children probably laughing at it, but mainly from the other Doctors, you would get... Perhaps once during a story, there's a scene where the Doctor does the big telling the baddie what he thinks of him. My problem here is that this seems to be constantly throughout the episode. And my main problem is that I don't think Ryan or Yaz has earned the right to pass judgment on people.
No, and I think that is called out by the script, though, when Yaz realises she's underestimated Tesla.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, then when they get taken up to the ship, Tesla steps up and tries to save Yaz when the Queen Scythra is like, well, she's useless to me. And Tesla's like, no, I need her. And the thing is, that is a total Doctor thing to do. Of, yes. I need my assistant.
Oh, yes, I can understand that, yeah. But there's a scene on the Scythra ship where Tesla admits that he actually sent a signal back to their ship, and the Doctor sort of looks at him saying, oh, that was a big mistake. And you can understand the Doctor doing that, because she probably realises how dangerous it was. But then Yaz just looks at Tesla and says, yeah, seriously, what are you thinking like that? She comes across as some girl standing in some seedy bar in Sheffield and saying, seriously, to some boy who's come to ask her to dance or something. Do people still ask each other to dance in bars these days? You know how much young girls would carry around dance cards. Who do you think you are? You travel around with the Doctor. You say and do bugger all, and you think that puts you on the moral high ground. It even becomes quite unpleasant at times when they start lecturing people who are involved in broken families. You know, they don't seem to stop to think, oh, there might have actually been some complexity in a family relationship which you don't get to comment on if you weren't there. But the doctor lectures Ryan's father for leaving him. And here, I think, is it Yaz or the doctor lectures Kane for leaving Bella? When actually, from what you can see, you might want to back out of this. It's not the end of your business.
I mean, the Kane thing, it gets us to the point where Kane says, I was doing this for her, I was going to give this to her. And the doctor doesn't really have a rebuttal for that. You know, I think it's the moment of, yes, possibly the doctor overstepping her bounds because she's not aware. It's, actually, that's what it reminds me of. When the doctor realizes in Silence in the Library, Forest of the Dead, that Lux is not protecting a patent, he's protecting a person, and softens in that situation.
Mark, can I get a word to Edgeway?
Yes, no, that's all right.
Between the two of us.
I found this one much more enjoyable the second time round as well. The first time round, I don't think I appreciated how well the plot hung together. I thought it was really well written. Even just little bits early on that you notice, like when Tesla's looking to see what's possibly wrong with his machine, he's like, oh, parts are missing and things, and it's quite a throwaway line, and obviously then that comes back in later. It looked fantastic, didn't it? Everything. I really do think the whole lighting, when they're sat in the office at one point, there's light streaming in through the windows, just looks beautiful, natural and beautiful. And the lighting on the, I nearly said Rachnos ship, the Scythra ship, the Scythra did make me think of the Rachnos.
Yes, I like the ship and I love the, I don't think much of the crew, but I love the scorpions.
Yes.
Particularly when they're running through the streets after them, going up the buildings and...
Oh, they looked much better when they were on Earth than they did when they all grouped together, I think.
That was all filmed in Bulgaria, apparently.
Oh, was it?
Stuff in the streets. Yeah.
Okay, where was the bit with Niagara Falls? Was that just...
I think that was...
What?
That was a set in a BBC bathroom. I assume that was just...
But yeah, the lighting on the Scythra ship, the costumes all looked fabulous. I think it's one of the best-looking stories we've had for a while.
And I must admit, I was feeling rather smug about Skyfall, because as soon as that woman says to the Doctor, hello, I'm Ada, I bet she'll end up being Ada Lovelace. So I thought puffing my fingernails on my lapel. I had no idea of Tesla and Edison's history together.
No, I didn't. This was the very definition, wasn't it, of the original premise of the show, in that it was educating as well as entertaining us. I certainly didn't know much about Tesla beforehand. Oh, I know you mentioned Yaz, Brendan. I thought this was one of the best Yaz stories, actually, because I think she gets underserved quite a lot.
Oh, that's definitely true.
And I think with this one, she actually got to do stuff. I mean, she did a bit of deduction with the radar line and stuff. Although it seemed a bit of a leap, didn't it? When this thing, it was pulsing like a radar.
He says to her, how do you know what's a radar? She says, oh, it uses energy waves to work out what's around you. Now, I think if they'd asked one of us, we'd have said, oh, it uses radio waves. For her to actually realise that that's still energy waves, I think that means that she knows enough about it to think she wouldn't never have heard of Nikola Tesla.
Mm.
She might not have had an encyclopedic knowledge of him, but I think she might have heard of him. But then this is Yaz.
Yeah.
I mean, finally, an opportunity for Yaz to use her professional policing skills in a Doctor Who story. And it finds out she's useless at clearing people off the streets in an emergency.
Oh, well, that's what I was going to say. Well, no, I thought she did quite well at that. At least she tried, and she was very good at...
She has the natural authority of a lollipop lady.
Well, that's probably why she was naturally very good at getting that kid off the street.
The thing is, though, like, I saw that criticism myself, and I kind of thought, I think Doctor Who wants to present the image of Yaz as a police officer who doesn't abuse her power.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than adopting the authoritarian approach, she's using the approach of your friendly neighbourhood police officer. Also, she doesn't want to say to people, get inside, there's monsters coming, because it's like yelling fire in a crowded theatre. You know, she's just like, really, get indoors. I'm not going to tell you what the danger is, but get indoors. I didn't have a problem with that scene. I know some people have seen it as Edison takes control of the situation and gets him indoors. Yeah, but he does it by lying. Whereas Yaz is not going to do that, and she's not going to deliberately panic people.
I think there's a middle road between a policeman abusing their power and being completely incompetent.
But as you say, she's not completely incompetent. She gets that child inside.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And she discovers that the Scythra's greatest weakness is bread.
Yes.
Once they have a bread line, can't cross
none
it.
None make pass.
Oh my god, they're celiac. The Scythra are celiacs. There you go.
Oh, can I just say, though, Jodie, I found, went from one extreme to the other in this story. There were moments where she's going back to doing her horrendous thing that I complained about all of last season, where she's like this all the time.
Yeah, so just that, yeah.
Oh, yeah. She's not doing anything. She's just literally standing there. She's been standing in a room with Edison, and she suddenly goes, trust me, Mr. Edison, we're not the enemy. And she's doing a gasping thing after teleporting again as well, which she seems to do a lot. And I just don't know why they choose to do that. It really cheeses me off. And I also don't enjoy her, I don't know if you'll get the reference or not, Brendan, but her sort of CBeebies style way of explaining things to people, where she's got a very definite way. CBeebies is a children's TV channel over here.
Mm.
And she's got a very particular way of, I don't know, the way she explains things sometimes. She did it a couple of times in this episode, and it just really rubs me up the wrong way.
Is that why she's making chopping motions with her hands in front of her?
Yes, yes.
Yes.
And sort of hunches over.
Talking about CBeebies presenters, who decided that Doctor should stay in a Mork and Mindy clown costume while the others are in period dress?
Hmm.
It's really starting to resemble Colin's costume.
Yeah, I've never been particularly a big fan of that costume. I find it very bland, to be honest, but...
I was going to say, I quite like her outfit, but I agree it would have been nice to have her in something of the period in this episode. I think there is a reluctance to put her in a dress. Mm. I think there's a reluctance on the part of the production team to put her in a dress because the casting of a woman as the Doctor has been so controversial already. But I think they could have then gone the other way, like they do in Spyfall. They don't put her in an evening frock. They put her in her own version of the tuxedo, still with the cut, the 3/4 length culottes, which looks amazing because it's still the Doctor, but it's the Doctor going, I'm not going to take your dress code seriously, you silly humans. I would have loved to see her in like a 3-piece heavy tweed suit for this story.
Yes.
Because it's not like they've just turned up. When we join them on the train, they're deliberately on their way to New York. You know, I take it that they've landed the TARDIS on the train, the train's going to New York in a couple of hours, the Doctor picks up something strange and go gets Tesla. That's how I take that scene. As for her explaining things, I actually love the breathlessness and the enthusiasm.
Really?
But thinking about why they may have made that choice, I wonder if it's because whenever Capaldi's Doctor explains something, he did it with an air of, why don't you know this already, you idiot?
Hmm.
Less so in his final season. So, a bit like Peter Davison to Colin Baker, they've gone, how can we make this as different as possible? And we make it as different as possible by making her love whatever the hell she's talking about. Like, the Saranga conundrum for all its faults. I love her speech about how antimatter propulsion works.
Yes, that's interesting. Well, she's in the little sort of Hitchhiker's Guide control room.
Yes.
All white and yes.
Yeah. And so here, you know, it's only Nikola Tesla. Look at him. Look, ever since she's been cast, I've been saying she's Victoria Wood in space. And she is. And I don't have much of a problem with that. But yeah, I would like to see some more variation to the costume. Because, you know, we've had several different colour rainbow t-shirts. And it's kind of like, okay, give us a different t-shirt. And now we've got a rainbow sweater as well. She was wearing a knitted rainbow sweater last week in Orphan 55. But it's like, okay, no, we get this. We can now vary this a bit more. We can say to Jodie, hey, Jodie, who's your favourite band? Right, we'll get you a Lynyrd Skynyrd t-shirt to wear as the Doctor and not explain it.
Tori Wood in space. Yaz can't be with us this week. I'm afraid she had an accident and scratched her Volvo.
Ryan, you're choking on a macaroon!
A thought for me that was the negative side of the coin with Jodie Whittaker's performance. Although I do like your explanation and reasoning for it, which has somewhat salved my pain. But I thought she was absolutely brilliant again in some of the scenes. I think some of her conversations with people, I think when she gets good cast around her, she's always better. Especially when she's in a one-on-one dialogue situation with a really good actor, like she was with Sasha in Spyfall, like she was with Witchfinders.
King James.
Yes, with King James in Witchfinders. And her, I think when she turns up on the Scythra ship and she just goes and stands straight in front of Yaz, stands in between the Queen in a protective manner.
Yeah.
A lot of people say she lacks authority, and I think occasionally she does, because sometimes I feel like the script or the direction make her a little bit too flappy, waving her hands around and a bit too, and a little less secure.
Mm.
And as Brendan says, that's probably a response to Peter Capaldi, like Davison was a response to Baker. It's just unfortunate that they just had to do that when it's the first woman actor. But yeah, but I think she's got great authority when she's on the ship. Like I say, when she defends, she gets in front of Yaz and talks down the Queen. And the dialogue there is fantastic.
Quite good when she's talking to him about the thrill of inventing things.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, her scenes with Edison where she's chatting to him about that as well. It's lovely, and her delivery's superb. And then there's that line, there's that bit where the Scythra Queen says, "Have you ever seen a dead planet?"
Yes.
And yeah, it's played brilliantly by Jodie Whittaker. She just looks, well, it's just a deathly stare, isn't it? It's fantastic.
It's a little strange that we get all three of them going into the TARDIS, but Edison and Dorothy, we don't get to see their reaction. We just end up seeing them sitting around. And it's only when Tesla goes in that he does that, "Oh my God, it's bigger on the inside than the outside." Which I think slightly takes away from it. The other thing I notice is, you know, Tesla's big speech to the Queen, "I won't work for you, I'll only work for progress." And then the companions are down in his laboratory looking through some of his prototype machinery, and they find one called Death Ray.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what form of progress he was working for there. But what I was going to say was, talking about, I thought it was a pity that the Scythra had to be added, really. Do we think that the pure historical, along the lines of, I don't know, the Crusaders, Marco Polo, the Aztecs, the Highlanders, enemy of the world, where an alien presence or monsters aren't involved, is now unworkable in Doctor Who? You know, it's something where you rely entirely on the interest of meeting the historical figures in a historical setting to offset the absence of the monsters or balmy technology. I mean, I suppose that for the kids, you might have to steer away from the likes of Tesla and Edison, who are possibly a bit recherche, and go more into, you know, the obvious things like Cleopatra or the Spanish Armada or something. If you think about it, Rosa came very close to this, didn't it? Yes, we had the utterly banal time-travelling racist, but he was much more of a distraction, wasn't he, rather than a key figure. If you imagine they'd got rid of him, and let's say the TARDIS team had arrived in this town in the Deep South, and let's say that in the course of wandering around the town, they accidentally saved someone who was destined to die from being knocked down in a traffic accident. And then it triggers a series of little events which are going to end up derailing Rosa's moment of decision on the bus. You know, let's say that person doesn't die in the accident, so his brother doesn't need to go to the funeral, therefore the rota of bus drivers doesn't need to be changed or something, something like that. Where, yes, you'd alter it slightly because of their presence as time travellers, but once they've arrived, it's just then a straight historical. Because we've seen that the BBC is prepared to splash the cash on location shooting and sets and costumes, even if he's not, perhaps not prepared to splash the cash on competent showrunners. Do we think that that's now unworkable for Doctor Who? There's an expectation that the kids will expect the Monster of the Week?
Yeah, I think on TV, I think it's unworkable, but from, as you say, an audience response standpoint. I am absolutely sure that they could do a historical plot. There's no reason they couldn't write a historical plot without any science fictional elements. But yeah, the audience expectation now is that science fiction elements will be involved in the story in some way, shape, or form. And I think unless they heavily publicized it as
being something different,
everyone would be watching the story, sitting on their seats going, when are the aliens coming in? When are the aliens coming in? Mm. When's the people from the future coming in? And, I mean, the pure historical in Doctor Who has basically been dead since 1967. I know we had a very brief revival with Black Orchid, but even with Black Orchid, the TARDIS gets turned into a taxi.
Yeah.
I can only presume that at the funeral, the Doctor mind wipes everyone who's seen inside the TARDIS. Oh, wait, no, sorry, that only has to happen to certain people from history. Need to be mind wiped. No, look, the whole thing with why didn't she mind wipe Tesla and Edison? It's like, well, Tesla and Edison weren't taken into the future. You know, I think that's the big caveat there. But it is still clumsy, to be perfectly fair. Look, I would love to see them do a really good pure historical Cleopatra or ancient Egypt. Yeah, brilliant. But I just don't... Okay, I don't think it's going to happen, but I think Chris Chibnall would be more willing to do it than Stephen Moffat and Russell T Davies. Because Chris Chibnall appears not to give a damn about what people think.
Yeah. I have to say, I was watching Tesla with some friends and I turned to their child who enjoys watching Doctor Who and I said, oh, this week it's a historical. And they scowled like they'd just been given a plate full of vegetables. they absolutely loved the episode in the end, and what made it for them was the fact when the kind of slightly zombified looking people with the red eyes were walking around, they were terrifying but in a good way.
Mm.
So they loved all the stuff with the aliens, but yeah, when I said to them, oh, it's another historical one, yeah, their faces, they weren't happy. So yeah, I don't think it would work these days, sadly. I think they could do it, and I think they could do it quite well, but I just, as Brendan said, I don't think the audience response would be right. There was a lot that I thought seemed quite familiar in this episode, as well as the Scythra Queen. They're not dead similar, but I definitely got a vibe of the Rachnos off the Scythra Queen. Was that just me?
Oh, no, I think definitely.
The way she questions the alien, they got the alien trapped and she starts questioning it, very spyful. Also, has anyone else noticed one feature of every story so far is someone leaping into a teleport with someone else? Every single story. Ada and the Doctor, Ryan and Bella, Yaz and Tesla.
Yeah, good point.
Oh, right.
Somebody's just about to teleport and somebody jumps in with them at the last minute. Every story.
And we know that the Jadoon like using teleporters.
Oh, so we might be in for another one.
Yes.
How long are you on tenterhooks now?
I'm going to be really disappointed if it's not in every episode now. Oh, Wardenclyffe. I didn't really know much about Wardenclyffe, but funny enough, it looked very familiar to me because I've been playing Red Dead Redemption 2, which is set in that era of the West. And at one point, whilst riding around with my outlaw, I came across an inventor who lived in the woods somewhere and near a mountain. And it was Wardenclyffe, basically. And I realise now that the character I was talking to was obviously Tesla.
Wow.
There we are, a bit of gaming nerdery. Oh, get your ship away from Earth, I thought sounded very familiar. That was very sort of 11th hour and, various.
Yes, yeah.
Christmas invasion and stuff, wasn't it?
Right, should we go on to Hayden?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, go on, then. So let's just pop out the Evil Joker set, turn it over. And listen to what Hayden has to say about Nikola Tesla.
Anyway, moving on then from that disappointment to Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror. With a title like that, this could have gone anywhere, really. But actually, it was a wonderful story. I absolutely loved this. I had a brilliant weekend. A lovely, lovely weekend. My sister-in-law came over to stay. Had a lovely family walk on Sunday as well, just before this. Had a roast dinner, sat down to watch Doctor Who, and was slightly trepidatious. But I had the twinkling possibility that this could be a stronger episode, because I think really one of the strong points of Chibnall's era so far even though we're 15 episodes in, is the historicals. The historicals have been by far, I think, the stronger episode so far, and I will count Spyfall in that because obviously we do go back in time, Victorian era, and of course war-torn Paris, World War II, 1940s, so I'll count that one in there too. I thought Goran Vinicic was tremendous as Nikola Tesla. It's one of those sort of Tony Curran moments, I think, really, where if you turned your head and watched out of the corner of your eye, you'd probably be forgiven for thinking, my God, that guy's a spitting image for Nikola Tesla, very much in the way that Curran was for Vincent van Gogh. I thought, yeah, I loved this one. I thought it was brilliant. I thought Robert Glenister was wonderful as Thomas Edison. Had a lot to do as well. And that's something else, you know, in this one, and same can be said for Series 12 as well. On the whole, everyone's got something to do so far. You know, I thought it was quite nice having Yasmin team up with Tesla and then Edison in this story. I thought it was well plotted. I thought it was well realised. I thought there were still clunky elements of the script. I mean, the script editing on Chibnall's era so far, I think, has been its biggest weak point because it doesn't allow the actors to really fully show off their range. But I feel like Jodie's gaining gravitas week by week now. I think Graham was superb, as always. Bradley Walsh has that lovely line about AC/DC, which was wonderfully set up earlier on. You can almost say it's very much the how those two were as polar opposites, actually, Tesla and Edison. And the wonderful thing about it, too, was that I was watching it with my wife, and she wanted to know more about Tesla after this, especially after talk about his world wireless system. That will spark people's interests off, and I think that's truly wonderful. I quite enjoyed Anjali Mahindra's turn as the Queen of the Scythra. I know they were very Monster of the Week, but I think as Monster of the Week go, they were actually really good. I wondered if there was some sort of relation there to the Rachnos from The Runaway Bride, but potentially not, I'm not sure. I mean, well, one was a scorpion, one was a spider race, but there you go. The Scythra were wonderfully realised. I quite enjoyed that. And Doctor Who's just so strong in a historical element, the tail end of the Victorian era over here in Britain, but just that era in general, that turn of the 20th century, is so enriched with science fiction. You know, obviously you've got the H.G. Wells at that point, it's very prominent. You've got science and technology changing the world too, and it makes Doctor Who Doctor Who just fits in that era. It really does. I thought it was wonderful. I really did. Very, very, very much enjoyed it. I've not really got much to complain about. Like I said, I think dialogue was a bit clunky in places, and makeup on the Queen of the Scythra was questionable, I suppose. But I'd be nitpicking, really. I mean, I must stress, I'm recording this the day after broadcast, so I haven't had a chance to go back and watch it again. But on first watch, I think as a debut script from Nina Medvia, I think as a debut script from Nina Medvia, it was incredibly strong. And I thought her writing was very well paced. This is the same script editor, of course, Fiona McAllister. How the pacing was so right with this one, but so off with Orphan 55. I don't know. It'd be nice to see if the show could have that kind of consistency. But then again, I think we do actually have to say that over the last 15 years of Doctor Who coming back, we have had a great episode then clunker following it, haven't we, all throughout all of these Doctor's eras. So there's nothing unusual about that. But very much I'd like to see Nina Medvia write for the show again. Yeah, I thought it was wonderful. Absolutely loved it. Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror. B-movie title. But a movie script, I thought. Yeah, I'm going to give this one a 9 out of 10. And I very much hope that you two enjoyed it too. And I hope to be back with you soon, all right? Take care, chaps. And thank you very much for listening to me, you lovely listeners. Take care. Bye.
So, Hayden gave it a 9. I'm going to give it a 7.5.
I also give it a 9. Really, the only disappointment for me is the very human body shape of the Scythra Queen, but I can't fault Anjali Mohindra's performance. Dear Anjali Mohindra, back in the Doctor Who universe after doing such splendid work on the Sarah Jane Adventures. So yeah, 9 out of 10 from me.
Yeah, I'd give it 8.5.
I'm feeling guilty now, but I'll stay where I am. My name was going to go with, like, you're the first instinct. Are you a Victorian Wood fan then, Brendan?
Yes.
Have you ever seen Victoria Wood Presents? Which is her doing things like, she's in the health spa or on daytime TV?
No. So I've seen, as seen on TV, Acorn Antiques, and she did a special.
That's her time. I think she's. It's about six half hour sketches, most of them involving Julie Walters at some time, which is where the Volvo line comes from. They're in a health spa.
Right.
And Julie Walters is playing the woman who runs the health spa, who's totally incompetent. And she's like Mrs. Malaprop. She's constantly getting her words wrong.
Oh, yes.
Which I hope today's regiment wasn't very astringent, ladies and gentlemen. And then she comes in the evening when they're all waiting for someone to arrive to give them a talk.
Body. Hope you all enjoyed your crudities. Nicola here. I'm afraid we don't have an organised activity as such on the agenda. Yes, we were hoping to have a twilight display of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation in the treatment lobby.
Resus.
Yes, but Mrs. Fernie, who can't be here, she had a slight accident and scratched her Volvo. But activities will be resumed tomorrow, and we will be circling a pamphlet to that intention so that you can exercise your choosing as and whenever. Hope you haven't found the first day's regiment too astringent. I know Captain Mile isn't everyone's cup of tea.
Hayden! Hayden, sorry. Brendan. You should have a DN at the end of your name.
Brendan.
Would you care now to accompany us into the main exhibition hall of the Hooseum?
Yes, please.
Computer, can you open the doors, please? Thank you. Oh, that whiff of window lean and pledge.
Oh, wow. It's...
You'll see, going into the distance in front of us, miles and miles of pristine display cases. Brendan, what have you brought us to go on permanent display at the Hooseum?
I have brought a big box version of Doctor Who Destiny of the Doctors for Windows PC. Now, are you both aware of this?
Yes.
No.
Is this the one with Anthony Ainley?
This is the one with Anthony Ainley. This is Anthony Ainley's final performance as the Master, and dare I say, one of his best. This came out around 1997, so it was in development in 1996, and Tom Baker, Peter Davison, Colin Baker, and Sylvester McCoy return to record new dialogue for this computer game.
Is this the one with a Silurian and a Sea Devil on the cover?
Yes, that's
a
right.
A Dalek and a Cyberman.
That's right.
Right, okay, yeah, carry on.
Yeah, John Pertwee was booked to record new dialogue, but passed away during the development period. So,
oh, right.
John Pertwee is represented by voice clips from the show. William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton are represented by the worst William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton impersonator I have ever heard.
You're not familiar with Hayden, are you, Brendan?
But, yeah, it's not John Gielor, who's done amazing work as Hartnell in the last few years, or Chris Thompson, of course. I think Chris Thompson's around my age, so he would have been far too young to do this, because I was a teenager when this came out. So the objective of the game is the Master has kidnapped all seven complete incarnations of the Doctor. Because they didn't have the rights to use the McGann incarnation during development. So they went, okay, well, this is how we'll explain it. And imprison them on the psychic planet Cyrillos, where he creates arenas for the Doctor's companion, the Grok, to get them. And you play as the Grok. You're an amorphous blob of plasma created by the Doctor. So, you know, that way they don't have to pay for anyone's likeness. And the TARDIS has fused with the planet Cyrillos. So you start off inside the TARDIS, you pick a doctor to go to, and you go to see the Master, and the Master gives you a mission to perform. So it's usually track down an object like a Metabolus crystal or a Nestine energy sphere, etc., etc., in the TARDIS. Each era's TARDIS has like an appropriate monster. So when you're trying to save the third doctor, you're fighting against Autons. When you're in the, I think, the fifth Doctor's TARDIS, you're against Sontaran, so maybe not that era appropriate.
No.
But look, it's not a great game.
even by the standards of the day, but it holds a great deal of nostalgia. Gary Russell was involved in it. I think Terrence Dix may have been involved in the writing of it. And Gary has given an interview about it where he basically says, you know, the BBC were very interested in getting into the interactive gaming sphere and full motion video because Anthony Ainley does appear on camera as the master doing all the recording links and whatnot. But he says pretty much money kept being siphoned out of it into Wallace and Gromit games. Because I think it's A Close Shave had come out recently. So the budget shrank and shrank and shrank. But for a gamer such as myself, at age 13, having a Doctor Who game to play on the PC, seeing Anthony Ainley's master just really enjoying himself, you know, and I think for once he wasn't being directed from the box to go bigger, 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 bigger. So there's a lot of fun moments in there of him. There's crazy things like to rescue the Fourth Doctor, you have to navigate yourself through the Doctor's brain while being attacked by a Rastan warrior robot. To rescue the Seventh Doctor, you have to race against the Master in... what's that sort of bubble car where the whole front of it opens and you've only got two seats?
The Hoobermobile.
Yeah, that is a bubble car, isn't it?
Sorry, you're right. This one, it kind of looks like a smart car. But the whole front of it opens, and that's the door. You're in Bessie, and the Master's in that, and you have to get in front of him and basically get him to rear-end you three times to stop his car.
Misses.
To rescue the Second Doctor, you're in one train, and the Master's in another train on the underground, and you have to race him avoiding Yetis.
Oh, wow.
It's utterly bonkers. It's incredibly hard to control. I don't know if I ever finished it properly, because I finished it twice. And both times the game crashed after I finished it. But there is a video file, because you can access the video file separately, there is a video file that implies there's more of the game afterwards, so I don't know if I ever finished it. Because what happens is you finish it, you get this amazing bit where around you the Seven Doctors appear. And then the Master gets put in prison, there's a great medley of the Doctor Who theme, and then the game crashes. But yeah, so... it's Doctor Who Destiny of the Doctors. Look, in my mind, there's only been one really great Doctor Who video game, and that is LEGO Dimensions. But this one, actually, in common with Orphan 55, it's a noble failure.
Mighty Orb, planet of pure mental energy. I, the Master, have harnessed the majesty of your psychic intellect and made you... my puppet. Through you, I shall fulfill my destiny to bend the universe unto my will. To begin, I summon the seven complete incarnations of the one known as the Doctor, a Time Lord who more than any other has sought to frustrate my destiny. The Doctor's seven past incarnations shall be summoned hither, where they shall be my prisoners, to be dealt with as I see fit. I shall encapsulate the Doctor's psyche within the depths of the determinant, the domain I have created through your conquered will. And I shall systematically eradicate all past and any futures of the one who has sought to undermine my supremacy. Oh, my Cyrillos. Verem Ue Evanal. Forth the Doctor. the most recent. One so busy setting plans and traps that he fails to see those set for him. Oh, look, the blustering one in the stupid coat. How he struts and gloats. Way, there's the nice one, such charm, such innocence, such naivety, such a fool. The Bohemian, the Wanderer. One so keen to abandon his roots that he abandoned his sense. Now, there was a worthy foe. Such cunning, such ingenuity. All wasted through that stubborn streak of goodness. The comedian! But a capable comedian, too. Not quite the clown he looks, this one. And there's the first. Such wisdom, such intellect. But oh, what a bore the fellow was. What?
hero, a challenger? Someone to defend your miserable existence, Doctor? Something you've cobbled up yourself by the look of it? Well, good luck, Grog. You'll definitely need it. The destiny of the Doctors is in your hands. Don't make me laugh.
It sounds fascinating. Is it available on the emulator? Can you get download an emulator for it anywhere? Or?
I think it ran on Windows 95. So okay. If you can find it somewhere, I'm sure if you can run Windows 95 games, you can run it there. I don't think it's on Steam. Yeah, I'm just wondering about that, where to find it. Actually, it's up on myabandonware.com.
Okay.
So, yeah, it looks like you can still find it and play it.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, it's having heard Gary Russell talk about it and kind of how much they pulled out of it, it's amazing it made it to the shelf at all. There's this database in there where you can look up characters and places. You look up the Fourth Doctor and it's got a video file of his whole Nerva Beacon speech. That's his representation. Ooh. You look up the Fifth Doctor and his representation is saying, "Quickly, come on," from Resurrection of the Daleks. And it's like, what? Not...
So are the Doctors contributing to this actually contributed proper speeches, or they're just saying things like correct or you're dead or something, or are they actually saying stuff?
They've each got about 10 voice files, and it's things like be careful, your energy is 50% gone. Sometimes they give you hints about where to go. It's like, no, it's not this way, it's that way.
They'd make great ringtones and notifications.
Yeah. And look, I don't know if this download from myabandonware is packaged in the same way, but on the disc, on the original disc, you could just, they were just WAV files.
Oh, right.
And you could get them there. And one that really haunts me is if you fail on the Sylvester McCoy level, because when you free the Doctor or get killed on the level, there's different voice clips depending on how you go. I mean, the First Doctor one is hilarious. It's a really bad impersonator saying, "Fade away! Away!" And that's not my Bad Hartnell impersonation. That's my bad impersonation of this Bad Hartnell impersonator. But the Sylve one, whereas everyone else kind of yells or screams, Sylve just says, "Go on, leave me here alone." And it's like, oh, that's horrible! Yeah, so it's the last time he plays the Master. All of those clips are on the Survival DVD, but I think they're not on the upcoming Blu-ray. I think the intention is to release like a 90s set, is what a lot of people are saying for the Blu-ray collection, and they'll be on there.
So did you have this, Mark?
No, I didn't have this, but I knew about it. No, the only Doctor Who video game I've ever owned, because I didn't even get the Lego Dimensions because I couldn't afford it at the time. I don't think I can afford it now, unfortunately. The only video game I've ever had was actually Dalek Attack, which was like a Game & Watch. And I think that's from the early 90s. Do you know what I mean by Game & Watch? Game and...
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I do, but...
Nintendo little things with a tiny LCD screen.
Did they never make into a video game that that Doctor Who game you were testing us on over Christmas, Mark?
Well, no, that's the FASA role-playing game.
Young adult. Oh. Attractive.
I had the Virgin Books Time Lord role-playing game, which is quite fun. I was a Heroes Unlimited player in my teenage years, but this Doctor Who RPG only needed D6. It didn't need D20s. That was scandalous.
Could you just translate for me, please? Just for me, please.
Six-sided dice and not 20-sided dice.
Oh, right. What is this reminding me of? This is reminding me of... Podcast 7 of ours. Back in 2014, it must have been. When friend of the show, Kevin Jordan, got in touch about a game called Deus Ex Machina.
Oh, yes, with John Pertwee.
Yeah. Oh, here we are. Oh, no wonder I've got no space on my hard drive. I've saved all these emails for years. Back in 1984, the ZX Spectrum was the home computer of choice, yet it only had 45k memory. My external hard drive is 10 terabytes, and it could only display 256 colours. But these limitations helped produce some of the most innovative and groundbreaking games ever. At the forefront of this innovation was Automata, run by the guru's guru Mel Croucher. It means nothing to me. My friends and I were Croucher acolytes, blah, 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 blah. But now they've released their magnum opus Deus Ex Machina, telling the epic multi-stage story of an accidental artificial life form. It was based loosely on Shakespeare's Seven Ages of Man. That was it. And they had John Pertwee reading out various Shakespearean...
Oh, yes, yeah.
With voiceovers and singing from Ian Dury and Frankie Howard.
What a dream team.
And if you want to find that, listeners, all the audio files are still on our podcast blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. And they're sandwiched in between, I think, podcast number 7 and podcast number 8. I'll put a direct link to it on the show notes for this podcast.
All the screens a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one person in their time plays many parts, their acts being 7 ages. At first, the infant, mewling in the test tube's neck. Then the whining school child, with cassette and shining morning face, creeping like a snail, unwillingly to data bank. And then the lover, sighing like a furnace, with a woeful video made to their lover's hologram. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking high score even in the laser's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly, with eyes severe, and clothes of formal cut, full of wise words and machine code. And so, they play their part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose, their youthful clothes well saved, a world too wide for their shrunken shank, and their adult speech synthesizer turning again towards a childish treble, piping and whistling in its sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange eventful history, is second childishness and mere oblivion. Without keyboard, without monitor, without power supply.
I'm the sort of person where I thrill to John Pertwee doing very portentous Shakespearean dialogue, but I probably wouldn't be able to get into the game myself. The first game I ever got when I got a PlayStation 1 was Tomb Raider 3, and it took me about 3 weeks to get off this cliff that she starts on without dying. Although I think my favourite game was... It's going up away from Doctor Who, probably Final Fantasy VII, which apparently they're re-releasing.
They have re-released it, yeah.
Or is this only one of many of yours, Brendan, that you had?
It was the only Doctor Who game I had for some time.
Isn't there one with Colin Baker's Doctor, and I cat called Splink or something.
Yes, I've played that, The Minds of Terror. That's actually quite good, and you sort of have to program the cat to do things. It's the robot cat.
Ah.
Come to think of it, as a very, very young kid on like a like pre-Windows computer, we had... I can't remember what the original game is called. I think the original game might just be called Robots, and you're one little figure, and every time you move, there's a bunch of robots around you who also move, and you can make them crash into each other, etc., etc. Well, there was a version that was reprogrammed, and the robot figures made to look like Daleks, and you had the power to use your sonic screwdriver once per level, which could destroy a Dalek next to you, and I did play that for ages as a kid. But yeah, during the 90s, I just ached for a Doctor Who game, and then I got this, and with the advent of the new series, there was Top Trumps game. In fact, I am literally sitting here with in my hand Doctor Who Top Trumps for the PlayStation 2, because I ordered this during the week and it just turned up the other day, which has Tennant and Martha on the cover. There were a couple of Matt Smith games. There was a very good game for iOS called The Mazes of Time. There were two much poorer games called Evacuation Earth and Return to Earth for the Nintendo DS and the Nintendo Wii.
Oh, there was the free games as well, wasn't there, from the Matt Smith era?
Yes, yes.
You could download, which I've still got on my computer somewhere.
Oh, I wish I did, right? Because they came out for PC and Mac. They're now available on Steam to buy, and I would happily buy them, but only the PC versions are available there. And I have a Mac, which is annoying. Then there was The Eternity Clock on PlayStation 3, which was meant to be the first of a trilogy. It had Matt Smith and Alex Kingston giving their voices, but it sold very poorly, and I believe the studio went out of business, so that never happened. Yeah, and then we get Lego Dimensions, which manages to be, like, really the best Doctor Who game. To buy it, yeah, you've got to buy the base Lego Dimensions kit, and then you've got to buy the expansion with Lego Peter Capaldi, Lego K9 and Lego TARDIS, but that then gives you like a 10-hour campaign and a Doctor Who hub world. And when the Doctor dies, he regenerates, and when you go back into the TARDIS, they actually change the interior set to match that. So yeah, Mark, if you manage to find one secondhand, they have ceased development on it. So there was a period here where the expansion packs were going very cheap, so you may get lucky. It is worth investing in.
I'll keep an eye out, yes.
Yeah, but in the meantime, Destiny of the Doctors for that hit of 90s nostalgia where it's like, we don't have the program, we will take whatever we can get.
Right, well, I think you may as well put this on display in our Aussie section.
Hooray.
Which we've just installed with extra strong sprinklers.
Yes, yeah, that's advisable. That's advisable.
Oh, you are right. Final Fantasy VII Remake is out. Fortunately, it costs £50. I'd also have to buy a PlayStation 4 machine as well, so I don't think I'll be... Oh, I would have loved to return to Cosmo Canyon.
Yeah, I think it's due out in April.
We've just received an alert from Mummerset International Airport that Brendan's privately chartered Qantas jet is revving up on the... Do jets rev up on the runway? So there's a high-speed limousine outside ready to whiz Brendan off to the airport. Thanks very much for joining us, Brendan.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you both for having me. I've had such fun.
And I think... I don't really think we need to invite Hayden back, do you, Mark?
No, so I'll keep the shotgun for him.
Oh, hang on, it's Bruce, Uncle Brucey, do you want something? Have you got a message for us?
Don't dump bodies into the river, bodies don't dump.
Uncle Brucey, we have enemy ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Be seeing you.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly dumb. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.